Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business. My name's Patrick Gray. Seriously Risky Biz is the podcast we do here at Risky Biz HQ, where we talk to Tom Uren about his weekly newsletter of the same name, which you can find at news.risky.biz. I recommend you go there and subscribe. We've got Catalin Kimpanu's Risky Business News newsletter, and we've also got Seriously Risky Biz. This week, Tom's work is being supported by Graynoise, which is a terrific company founded by Andrew Morris. Does a lot of, you know, analysis of internet traffic, finds bad stuff. You can find them at graynoise.io. And of course, we would also like to thank the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation and Lawfare for working with us on all of this. Tom, great to see you. And we're going to talk, you've written about three things in this week's newsletter in detail. The first thing we're going to talk about, we're going to go backwards just because I like to be a bit different. But we're going to start with your third item here, which is something that happened with D-Link network attached storage devices, where what's happened effectively is that someone found a bug in them, which was real bad. It was like a hard-coded user, which doesn't even have a password. So you just enter that user and bang, via a GET request, and you get full access to the device. So that's bad enough. But where it gets real bad is that D-Link doesn't really have a way to update these things or even notify users of a problem. So they their response is just to end of life them, which, I mean, they don't really have many other options. But I think where this is interesting is where you argue that we need to perhaps regulate or do something to prevent these sort of situations arising again in the future.
Yeah, that's right. It's part of the story that first caught my attention was there was a claim that over 90,000 devices were affected and accessible on the internet. Now, it seems like the true number is a lot less than that, 5,000, give or take.
Funnily enough, we know that because Graynoise actually used Census to identify the true number because they're tracking the exploitation of this thing over the internet.
Yeah. So there's the Graynoise part is interesting. So they actually got that 5,000-ish number from Census, but they're also receiving who on the internet is trying to exploit this. So there's hundreds of IP addresses trying to exploit this. These type of vulnerabilities tend to end up in botnets or even nation state controlled botnets.
Yeah, because as we know, like a lot of these state actors these days, they love building up jump box networks of compromised IoT devices, just like these, right? Because it options to appear to be from where they need to appear to be from.
Yeah, and focusing on devices that aren't going to be patched or can't be patched, like it's a great idea because what can people do? Like the vast majority of the users of these devices are probably never going to know that they've been used maliciously. So to me, putting on my economist hat, and you know, I'm not an economist.
I didn't know you had an economist hat. There you go.
I've got many hats. I'm not an economist, but I put on the hat occasionally.
Yeah, good.
You're taking a problem that should be D-Link's problem. How do you keep these devices secure over time? And you're making it a public problem.
Yes.
So all of a sudden, there's now potential harms diffuse, usually, all over the internet because D-Link's not doing any work. And so we've seen examples of where governments have stepped in and tried to tackle these botnets and disable them and sinkhole them and stuff like that. And when you think about it, those operations are very, very expensive because they take lots of people from all sorts of different organizations, government, public sector, lawyers, you know, tens of people working for quite a long time, and then they partially fix the problem to a greater or lesser extent. Sometimes they do better than others. And so to me, this seems like a classic example of where the vendor doesn't have any responsibility. It basically unilaterally decides we don't want to do anything more. And that means that someone else comes along to clean up the mess.
Yeah, and it's funny because when you hear people talk about like liability reform in software, usually they're thinking, oh, about vulnerabilities and whatever and code quality and whatnot. And I think that's actually a very tricky area to start messing around with personally. Like I believe me I've surprised myself by coming down more on the software maker's side of that thing. When it comes to this stuff though, it seems a little more clear cut that you know that they should ship. And indeed, we've got all sorts of guidelines now out from various governments saying, well, if you're going to sell IoT devices, they need to be capable of receiving remote updates. There's, you know, certain requirements. They need to have, you know, encryption here and there and whatever. And I think this is one where regulators could get a win, because they could eventually get to the point where someone wants to end of life a device that they still do have control over, and a regulator can just say, no, you're going to patch.
Yeah, so there's a contrasting incident where LG makes smart TVs, and the story is that 90-odd thousand LG smart TVs are on the internet for some reason and are susceptible to four different vulnerabilities. And LG actually has the capability to patch these devices remotely. So that's a great start. And then I think the question is, okay, they can do that. How long should they be required to do that? You know, I think supporting devices indefinitely is probably not the right answer.
Well, I don't know. I actually don't know about that, because I think it comes back to something you said earlier, which is, what's the risk to the public? What's the level of public harm that might come as a result of this? Now, if LG's got a million odd devices out there that are vulnerable, and it would be fairly low effort to fix them because they can remotely patch them, then, you know, this is what I'm saying. It might be a situation where demanding that they do it, doesn't seem unreasonable to me. Now, you know, are those TVs going to be around for 10 years? Probably not. Like most of them, you know, the average life of a TV is, you know, probably somewhere between 5 and 10 years. But you hear what I'm saying, right?
Yeah. I was actually thinking of sort of along similar lines, you know, what is the impact? How many devices do you have? If you only ever sold 100, well, probably doesn't matter. If you sold 10 million, well, probably there's quite a long tail on that, unless they die within a year or two.
And thanks to things like Shodan and Census, we know how many are left, right? So that's the nice thing, if these things are publicly accessible, we know about it.
Yeah. So I thought that was a very interesting contrast, that kind of incident. You know, the TVs are more modern, they can be patched. But, you know, who knows when LG will say, yeah, we're done with these.
Yeah.
And it's like LG models or TV models, they change all the time. So it doesn't make sense to just say, well, we've got a new model, so we're not going to support these old ones. I think LG would be more sensible than that. But I think there is a space to actually have some guidance, regulation.
Yeah. I'm a happy LG customer, by the way, with their TVs. Their TV OS is actually the better one, right?
Yeah,
I was recently visiting a friend's place in Melbourne. I flew down, and he had a Samsung, and he just spent most of his time cursing the Samsung OS because he'd switched over from an LG. It was funny. Anyway, people who want to read about that can head over to news.risky.biz and read your analysis there. But let's move on to our next topic now. And I'm going to go completely wild, Tom, and I'm going to go back to the first thing you've written about. So we're going then second, because I'm just crazy. It's out of control over here at Risky Biz HQ. But you've written up, you know, a piece here that looks at just how far away some states are straying from what the West would consider to be norms for cyber campaigns. And in particular, you've looked at this honeypot campaign, which has targeted politicians in the UK. Like, it seems pretty obvious, but I don't know, people are dumb, so they might go for it, particularly men. Men are dumb, so they might fall for this thing.
It was also relatively sophisticated in that politicians meet a lot of people, and the messages referred to meeting someone
at an event that they actually attended. Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
Don't you remember me? We met at the thing, you know?
Exactly. So it establishes, on false pretenses, some sort of personal relationship immediately. And I think that's the difference between this type of campaign and something you just get randomly wrong message.
It's not spam. I mean, obviously they've put a bit of work into it, but I mean, that's pretty basic pretexting, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's not super sophisticated. I think it's just a step up from
clearly
the
targeted
spam,
I think, is the point that you're trying to get at. Yeah.
Yeah. And what struck me is that honeypots are a thing. But the scale and the brazenness is what I think crosses a line when it's all your politicians all the time.
Yeah.
I think that's what sets people off rather than...
And the objective of these contacts seems to be to trick people into sending compromising images of themselves. You know, I mean, there's a simple way to say what they're after there, but I'm not saying it. They want dick pics. Okay, I've said it. They want dick pics. And, you know, the thing that occurred to me, though, is then what, right? So say you've got this compromising material. How is whoever's behind this campaign planning on using that material? Are they going to lean on people for certain, you know, votes or policies? I mean, you know, that's the bit that's really troubling for me. I mean, it's one thing to collect this stuff, but it suggests that there's a plan to use it.
Yeah, there is a story about one politician who admitted they'd fallen for it and had shared contact details of other people. The thing about that kind of espionage is that it's an escalating, is it a ladder, where, you know, you do one thing and then that gets you on the hook for the next thing that's slightly worse, and then the next thing. And so who knows where it ends up, but the idea is to gradually ratchet up the pressure and the value of whatever you're getting.
So it's less about influencing their work in policy and more about just getting them to do bits and pieces and escalate.
Well, I guess who knows?
Yeah, who knows where it winds up? Yeah, I get what you mean. Yeah.
So it was. I think the value in talking about it in the press is that it gets people to realise what's going on and perhaps stop themselves from going further. And so this was caught at a relatively early stage. So hopefully not too much damage done.
And you've also written about some of the influence operations that China's doing. Funnily enough, I reckon I've seen them, and these aren't campaigns that have been sort of publicly disclosed and whatever, but I've seen stuff on Twitter, not even recently, like maybe last year, year before. I saw stuff where there was a lot of commentary on Australian politics and things like AUKUS coming from bot-like accounts that was just insane and very much aligned with China's interests that just made me think there's no way that's a real person. Like, I mean, there's plenty of dummies out there, right? But no way. There was a real push. There was a real blip in that for a while. But, you know, what you've written about here is the Dragon Bridge stuff, which is that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. In a Microsoft report, it says that campaigns covered claiming a US weather weapon started wildfires in Hawaii, amplifying outrage over nuclear wastewater disposal around Fukushima, and advancing conspiracy theories over a train derailment in Kentucky. And I'm not religiously online, but I'd heard of all three of those conspiracy theories.
Yeah, as soon and as there you was mentioned them, I'm others. Like, I remember the space lasers causing the Hawaii thing, you know?
and so,
as I said, there's plenty of dummies out there.
So I think what the value of someone like Microsoft or civil society collating the information about it and assigning it to a group is that until they do that, you've got this doubt. There are a lot of dummies out there. It doesn't feel right, but it's helpful to have a kind of endorsement that it is inauthentic, some sort of affirmation that what you're listening to is just or looking at is just rubbish and confected.
Instead of my vibe opinion when I'm looking at various tweets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so this, because it directly interferes in US domestic politics, that seems to be, to me, that is the line that is being crossed. That's a kind of no-no, or if you do it, you do it very, very carefully so you don't get caught.
Yeah.
it's the lack of discretion that is.
You know, they don't care.
Yeah.
You know, and we've known that for a while. They don't care. And the best thing for them in doing this sort of misinformation is you say, oh, look, it was a Chinese operation. And the people who believe these theories say, yeah, sure it was.
Yeah.
They don't believe you. You know, so even if you get caught, I think it doesn't really inhibit your ability to do harm this way, right? And that's what makes it so insidious.
Like, there are people out there who believe this stuff. I don't know how much it changes. So I've kind of...
Well, this is back and forth. This is a much bigger conversation about disinformation, right?
Yeah.
How well it works.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is interesting that this is the first time I can point to those stories and go, okay, yes, I have heard of those, even though...
But they may have just been amplifying stuff that was already there, right? So
Yeah. Or they may be legitimate legitimate voices that have been amplifying things that they sort of seeded. It's like,
well, Tom, let's just hope the Illuminati keep their lasers off the other Pacific islands for now, mate. Let's just hope. Now, look, the final thing we're going to talk about is there is finally a bipartisan privacy bill being considered in the United States that actually looks pretty good. The funny thing is, though, the politicians roll this thing out and they say, see, we're taking big tech to task, you know, and do this whole rhetoric around big tech, which isn't really, you know, big tech isn't really the problem with this stuff. It's more the data broker ecosystem, app developers, whatever. Facebook's not going to sell user data directly to people anymore, right? They realize that was dumb. Google's not going to do it. Apple's not going to do it. So it is pretty funny that they're talking about this as like a big blow against big tech when really they're not the you know,
yeah,
so that doing was, the worst of it, right?
Yeah, that was my main takeaway from this, is that, like, as far as the bill goes, there's a lot to like. There are things I'm not so certain about, but what I really sort of focused on was that, you know, they talk about big tech prohibiting them from, you know, doing all these things, which
that they're
I
not
don't
doing
think,
anyway, yeah.
Well, I don't think that's the real problem. Like you said, it's not the real problem. Their incentive is to protect your data and take advantage of it and make money.
Yeah.
And
they don't
want
to sell it to
that.
You so you can take advantage of it, because, you know, they're going to make more money offering, you know, we can target ads based on our data and whatever. We're not going to give you the data. Like, they've learned that lesson.
And I think the political rhetoric takes advantage of the fact that what a lot of those companies do feels very, very creepy. Just the amount of data that a company like Google or Meta knows about you as an individual, like, it just feels weird. And I think Apple has played into that by portraying themselves as the privacy preserving company. Where I think there probably is an element of that, but it's also an element of using that to beat some of their competitors on the head with the privacy stick. And so I think that all gets conflated into big tech bad. And so the bill is taking advantage of the public perception of big tech bad.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, I had a conversation with a politician a couple of years back, just, you know, just talking generally about politics. And I think what they said is politics is all about narrative, you know, and it was really in relation to something like this. And, you know, if a few nerds who work for a podcasting company in Australia, you know, have an issue with it, they don't care. They want to be able to stand at a podium and talk about things that people care about, even if those things aren't, you know, what they should be caring about. So it's just, you know, it's politics, right?
Yeah. And I was in two minds about this. Like, if the bill passes and they need to demonize big tech to get it passed, okay,
so be it.
On balance, that's probably
exactly
a good thing.
We're on board. That's
but
fine.
But seriously, Risky Biz, we're meant to educate a type of person who actually cares about getting things right. So I thought, okay, I'll write a few paragraphs about this.
I will allow myself to be grumpy on this one.
Set the record straight.
Yep.
And then, Bill, off you go. I hope you get passed.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, Tom Uren, thank you very much for the discussion and the excellent newsletter this week. It's a pleasure to chat to you as always, and we'll do it again next week.
Thanks a lot, Patrick.